everyone. This is Chinese teacher, Avian. You are listening to the Deathcast, True Crime Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our final look at the life and legacy of Joseph Paul Franklin. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, as well as access to exclusive series like the coverage I did on the Columbine Massacre, just as my friends Channel and Anthony have done, as well as my largest Patreon contributors, Debbie, Samantha, Mike, and Becky. Again, that's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. All right, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! When we left off last time, Franklin had been convicted in both federal and state court for the murders he had committed in Salt Lake City, Utah. Utah had sought the death penalty in Franklin's case, however, they were only able to get life sentences, much to the chagrin of the district attorney's office. When questioned about this later, a number of the jury members all said that they were not strongly enough convinced that Franklin had committed these crimes to recommend the death penalty. Franklin's story does not end there, however. The federal government was looking to bring further charges against Franklin, as were numerous states who all felt that Joseph Paul Franklin was more likely than not the suspect that they had been looking for their own sniper murders. The federal government was specifically looking to link Franklin to the attempted assassination of civil rights leader Vernon Jordan, stating, quote, "We followed literally thousands of leads, and this is by far the best one. The FBI have told me they feel 99% sure it's Franklin, but until an arrest is made, there will continue to be frustration. Franklin has not been eliminated as a suspect, but neither have we isolated him as a prime suspect. We need something more significant to develop to solve this thing. It's like finding your way in the dark." Joseph Paul Franklin was being housed at the medical facility in Springfield, Missouri. This was a federal facility where he was being held for psychological evaluations. We know that while he was at the facility in Springfield, Franklin encountered a man by the name of Frank Sweeney, who was also a white supremacist, who's eventually going to turn state's evidence against Franklin. Sweeney said that Franklin told him about numerous murders he had committed, while also admitting to him to having attempted to assassinate Vernon Jordan. And although the FBI characterized Sweeney as an unreliable witness who could neither pass nor fail a polygraph test, they felt sure enough in his statements that eventually they're going to decide that he is acceptable as a key witness in the Vernon Jordan case. While the federal government is building this case against Franklin, it's decided that he needs to be moved to a maximum security prison. This is in Marion, Illinois, which is often considered to be the place that the federal government sends the worst of the worst. This would later be replaced by the USP in Terre Haute, Indiana. But at the time, the prison in Marion was where you sent the prisoners who were troublemakers, who were incorrigible, constantly got into trouble, or who were considered to be a violent risk to other prisoners. So on January 31st, 1982, Franklin is sent to Marion, where he is put into a non-segregated unit. This was because federal authorities believed, rightly so, that Joseph Paul Franklin would be a target for African-American and Hispanic prisoners who wanted to make a name for themselves by taking out a well-known white supremacist. See, Franklin was already becoming something of a folk hero in the white supremacist movement within the United States. People were looking up to him and his exploits, whether they were real or ones that there was only a suspicion that he had been involved in. And Franklin is going to go on to inspire some pretty insidious crimes, as well as literature. Now, about the federal prison in Marion, up until 1979, it had simply been a maximum security prison. In 1979, it was redesignated as a level 6 institution, which makes it a supermax. In fact, it was the United States' first supermax prison. One corrections officer who worked there stated every warden in the entire system suddenly had an opportunity to get rid of his worst inmates by sending them to us, and that is exactly what they did. I'm not certain that anyone in Washington really understood just how many bad apples we had streaming in here. It's been said that upon arriving in Marion, Franklin put word out to the other white prisoners that he was looking to get his hands on a knife so that he could defend himself. According to Franklin himself, the Aryan Brotherhood, also known as the AB, which is the largest white supremacist gang in the United States prison system, offered Franklin a knife on the condition that he join their organization. Now, for those not familiar with the Aryan Brotherhood, they were started in the 1960s. Some reports state that they were formed in Pelican Bay is a response to the Mexican Mafia. Others that they were formed in San Quentin as a response to the Black Gorilla Family, which was an African-American prison gang that was in the formative stages during this period of time as well. They had extremely storied history throughout the 1960s and 1970s, including connections to Charles Manson and his family. By the time of the 1980s rolled around, the Aryan Brotherhood really had moved away from the neo-Nazi ideology they'd had, adopting more of the white supremacist Norse mythology that began to become prevalent in some circles of the white supremacist movement as they got more and more involved in the trafficking of drugs, prostitution, extortion, murders for hire, that type of thing. According to Franklin, none of that jibed with him. He wasn't interested in getting into an organization whose primarily reason for existing at this point in time was a continuing criminal enterprise. So instead of joining up with the Aryan Brotherhood, Franklin does the unexpected and befriends an African-American man who is also housed in the same cell block as him. Cell Block F, which was basically segregation, as they had about an hour and a half outside their cells during the day, during which point they pretty much stood inside of a hallway. The actual recreation time for prisoners in this particular cell block was 1 hour per week in the winter and 2 hours during the summertime. We know that Franklin informed this prisoner that he had in fact shot Vernon Jordan, and it may be because of this that on February 3rd at roughly 6:40 p.m., a period of time during which all of the cells inside cell block F were open, a group of black convicts cornered Franklin as he entered the cell of another prisoner and, using a homemade knife, stabbed him 15 times in the neck and abdomen. Franklin was able to make his way out of the cell under his own power, at which time a prison guard saw him and rescued Franklin from further assault. Franklin ends up being taken to a hospital for emergency care. Interestingly, the FBI, which oversees these types of cases in federal prisons, chose not to prosecute Franklin's attackers. However, the FBI did state that Franklin had refused to identify the individuals who had assaulted him. Speaking some point later, Vernon Jordan stated of the stabbing, "This was really my last extended thought about Joseph Paul Franklin." After being returned to the prison, Joseph Paul Franklin was placed into K Unit, which was much more controlled than every other unit inside of the prison. It was an area where 7 inmates were housed within the basement of the prison. This is basically full-scale isolation. These cells were quite a bit larger than those in other areas of the prison, with the cells measuring 11 by 9 feet. They contained their own showers, toilets, as well as sinks. Prisoners were confined to their cells for roughly 22 hours a day and were not allowed out of their cells when other prisoners in this unit were out of the cell. So basically, only one prisoner could leave their cell at a given time. In addition to this, prisoners in K Unit at Marion were not allowed visitors, nor were they allowed to interact with anyone from the outside. Now, while Franklin was housed at Marion, a rather notorious incident took place, but we need some background. Marion Federal Penitentiary had been the site of acts of extreme violence between various prison gangs, but also aimed at corrections officers. Now, this really came to a head on October 22nd, 1983, this period of time during Franklin's life that we are talking about, when 2 corrections officers ended up being murdered. Now, I said earlier that Marion was the first super prison, and this incident is actually what led to its being designated officially as a supermax. These 2 officers were Merle Klutz and Robert Hoffman. Now, on this date, Officer Merle Klutz was escorting a man by the name of Thomas Silverstein. Silverstein was serving time for various robberies, as well as the murder of another inmate. According to reports, Silverstein was being led to the showers by Klutz when he was able to distract the guard, go to another prisoner's cell. The prisoner handed Silverstein a shank and also was able to take Silverstein's handcuffs off. At this point, Silverstein began to stab Officer Klutz, which resulted in Klutz dying. Silverstein later stated that this had occurred due to the fact that Klutz had been routinely harassing him. Now, a few hours after this, an associate of Silverstein by the name of Clayton Fontaine killed another officer, Robert Hoffman, in the exact same manner that Silverstein had done. It should be noted that Fontaine and Silverstein had ties to and were members of the Aryan Brotherhood and had killed an inmate together at another federal prison. Marion ends up going into an indefinite lockdown, which is the birth of the Supermax, which lasts for 23 years. Basically, what this means is prisoners aren't allowed out of their cell except for necessary reasons such as showers. Food will be brought to their cells, that type of thing. So this is the environment that Joseph Paul Franklin now finds himself in. He would later state that the prison was absolutely awful, with broken out windows that were never repaired, to the extent that oftentimes he would have to fill his blanket with newspapers to keep warm, as the draft from the broken windows made the cell block that he was housed in inhospitable. Back on to Joseph Paul Franklin, unbeknownst to him, the federal government was gearing up to press charges against him for the attempted murder of Vernon Jordan. At some point during his incarceration, Franklin was videotaped signing legal documents. Some sources say that this was at Marion, others that it was while he was at the Salt Lake City County Jail. In any event, this video was shown to Mary Howell, who was the white woman that was with Vernon Jordan on the day that he was shot. Howell informed the FBI that Franklin resembled an individual that she had seen in Fort Wayne, Indiana, the day before the shooting took place. It should be noted that at the time, the FBI refused to comment on the filming of Franklin, as his lawyers had publicly stated that this filming of him while he was inside of prison without his consent was a violation of his civil rights, and they were looking to bring charges against the federal government for this activity. At this point, there were stories coming out in the press that the FBI was considering offering Franklin a plea bargain should he plead guilty to the shooting of Jordan. These same stories stated that federal prosecutors were prepared to offer Franklin an immunity deal should he plead guilty, to ensure that local authorities would not be able to hold him accountable for other crimes that he may have committed, with which they were planning on bringing charges against him for. However, whether or not this plea bargain was ever presented to Franklin is unknown. Some sources state that this was presented to Franklin and he rejected it. Others that state prosecutors had barred this plea bargain from going forward. On June 2nd, 1982, despite feeling they did not have enough evidence to prosecute him, Joseph Paul Franklin was officially arraigned on charges that he had violated Vernon Jordan's civil rights. Commenting on the indictment, Vernon Jordan said that he was not convinced the federal government had an open and shut case, saying, quote, "The state of Indiana declined to prosecute Franklin, saying there was not enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he had shot me, but the federal government moving forward with its case. I was not much involved in the legal proceedings surrounding Franklin. That was for law enforcement to deal with. Section 245 was a very weak basis on which to have proceeded because the prosecution had to show that I had been shot because my attacker was trying to prevent me from using a public accommodation. That was never the issue. I was shot because I was black and in the company of a white woman. Not long after this indictment comes down, Franklin is transferred to the Metropolitan Correction Center in Chicago. Franklin requests a transfer to a county jail as he states through his lawyers that both staff and prisoners have made threats against his life. The trial officially starts on August 9th, 1982, with Franklin's attorney telling the jury during his opening statement that although Franklin had been convicted of a double homicide and was an alleged racist, quote, the evidence will show we don't know who shot Vernon Jordan, and that is a hard pill for the government to swallow. While the prosecution in their opening statement said, while there was no eyewitness testimony going to be presented, and they did not have any physical evidence to link Franklin to Jordan's shooting, the government had amassed a mountain of circumstantial evidence that he felt confident would show the jury that Franklin was indeed the gunman. Prosecution also said that they had one witness who would testify that they had seen Jordan while in prison pretending to aim a rifle at the television while a black man was on screen and stating, quote, I'm going to shoot him just like I shot Jordan. The prosecution also said that they would have another inmate witness who was watching television with Franklin when a piece on the Atlanta child killings came on. This inmate, said the prosecution, would testify that Franklin not only approved of these murders, but stated he wished that more people would follow the example being set by Atlanta. The next day, Vernon Jordan and the surgeon who had operated on him took the stand and testified, with Jordan saying that he never saw the person who had shot him and had not even heard the report from the gun. After this, there was a slew of police officers and FBI agents who testified, all of whom described finding the matted down area of grass in the island across the street from the Marriott Hotel where Jordan had been gunned down. A witness then took the stand and described that a man resembling Joseph Paul Franklin came in just after the shooting and bragged about having committed the act, closing with, quote, it was perfect. If I had been just a little different, it would have gotten him just right. The prosecution rests their case on August 13th. On August 16th, the defense begins to present their case, with Jordan taking the stand in his own defense where he declares that he had not shot Vernon Jordan. Asked about his racial views, Franklin stated, I don't hate every individual. I hate the black race as a whole. I don't believe in race mixing and things like that. Franklin also stated that witnesses who testified as to him bragging about having committed the attempted assassination were all lying, and that the prisoners who had testified were all plants by the FBI. Franklin admitted that while the handwriting found at the hotel registry in Fort Wayne was similar to his own, he was not in Fort Wayne in 1980, stating he did not know where he was when Jordan was shot. The following day, August 17th, the jury was sent to reach a verdict. Now, it should be noted that the jury needed to reach two different verdicts. One, that Franklin had shot Vernon Jordan. But two, Franklin had shot Vernon Jordan in an effort to deny Jordan the right to use the facilities at the Marriott Hotel. Now, I'm not denying that Franklin shot Vernon Jordan, but it is an extreme stretch of the imagination to think that Franklin shot Jordan in an effort to disallow him from using the facilities of a hotel. And I honestly believe that this was an extreme case of government overreach in even trying to put this case on him with that caveat in order to state that Franklin had violated Jordan's civil rights. From everything we know about Joseph Paul Franklin, denying someone access to a hotel is not even in the scope of the reasons why he would open fire on them. His entire reason for doing it rested solely on the fact that Jordan was black, and Franklin saw him in the presence of a white woman. Surprisingly, the jury returned with their verdict at 8:55 p.m., and Franklin was found not guilty. And again, while Franklin did shoot Jordan, I cannot say that the jury reached the wrong conclusion in this case, as the government had not proved that Franklin intended to stop Jordan from using the hotel. Remember, this wasn't an assault case or an attempted murder case. This was a civil trial. After the trial, one of the jurors stated, "I think most of us, our gut feeling was that he did it. But we could not go by gut feeling. We had to go on evidence, and there really wasn't enough evidence to prove guilt." While another juror stated, "The indictment was not proven on all points." Following Franklin's not guilty verdict, Fort Wayne County prosecutors announced that they would not prosecute Franklin for this crime, as there was not enough evidence to charge Franklin with the assassination of Vernon Jordan. Because of this verdict, a number of states decided not to pursue charges against Franklin for murders that had taken place in their jurisdiction. We do know that Franklin apparently reached out to a number of police departments following this verdict, wanting to talk with them. On February 29th, 1984, at Marion Penitentiary, Joseph Paul Franklin, waiving his Miranda rights, confessed to the bombings that he had carried out in 1977. He ends up being indicted for these crimes. He ends up standing trial July 10th through the 12th, 1984, in Chattahoochee. Franklin ends up being found guilty and sentenced to 15 to 21 years for the bombing, and 6 to 10 years for possession of explosives. It's interesting to note at this point that right before the jury's verdict came back, a taped piece aired in Atlanta with Joseph Paul Franklin, where he stated that a prominent Atlantean had paid him to shoot Larry Flint, the pornographer. Why this is interesting is that no such evidence has ever come out to prove Franklin's statement, and it's more likely than not that he's just saying this to get his name on in the headlines. On June 12th of 1984, Franklin is officially indicted for the attempted assassination of Larry Flint. However, the charges would be left in abeyance as other jurisdictions came after Franklin. On February 10th, 1986, Franklin goes on trial for the murders of Alfonso Manning Jr. and his girlfriend, Toni Schwen. Franklin had confessed to this crime while on the phone with Madison, Wisconsin authorities, and based on this confession, as well as circumstantial evidence that they had found, they decided to move forward with their prosecution of Franklin. This case in particular is the reason why the charges concerning Larry Flint were set aside for the time being, as they wanted to see whether or not Franklin was going to be found guilty of this double homicide. We will be back in just a moment. Hey there, my D&Ders. This is your old buddy Ian here with a brand new sponsor this week. Now, you've all heard me talk about Chinese teachers in the past. I have never promoted a Chinese teacher quite like Chinese teacher Evian. Evian is a sweet, honest, and dedicated teacher who teaches every day. She not only makes certain that her students understand the differences in tonal pronunciation, she allows them the opportunity to get up during the class and read what it is that she is teaching so that each student knows that they are getting the best possible education and is pronouncing the words and tones correctly. So I'd like you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/EvianCT and check her out. That's tinyurl.com/EvianCT. She makes learning this beautiful and wonderful language a lot of fun. And remember, Mandarin Chinese is the fastest growing language in the international job market today. This is the language that you want to learn if you don't want to work that boring 9-to-5 job, but you want to get a foothold in a company that has an international presence. They're all looking for Mandarin speakers, so let Evian be the one to introduce you to this language. You won't be disappointed. Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week, Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. As he had in Salt Lake City, Franklin acted as his own attorney, seconded by an actual attorney appointed by the state. The juries in this case heard the recorded phone conversation between Joseph Paul Franklin and Madison authorities, where he discussed checking into the hotel using the name John Wesley Harding and how he had planned to kill someone the following day. Specifically, a judge that Franklin said was too lenient on sentencing black youths. In this recording, Franklin says that his plans changed, however, when he was in the parking lot of a shopping mall and saw Manning and Schwen together. At which point, Franklin details to the authorities how he had committed the murder, what he did afterwards, and how he had fled the scene and disposed of the weapon. Now, according to Franklin, as he addressed the jury, he had faked the confession to get out of prison, specifically the Marion prison, telling the jury that the police had made up some parts of his confession in order to pin the crime on him, saying, quote, "The evidence in this case will show that the defendant was not the perpetrator of this crime." Franklin said that his whole reason for admitting to this crime was to get out of the brutal conditions of Marion Prison, quote, "totally concocted by the defendant's imagination." Franklin ends up being convicted for both of these crimes. After this conviction, the Gwinnett County District Attorney's Office decides not to pursue Franklin for shooting Larry Flint. On Sunday, August 19th, 1990, Joseph Paul Franklin admitted to having committed the murders in Salt Lake City to a reporter from a television station, saying, quote, "Yes, the answer is yes, I won't discuss it any further." When told that David Martin's mother needed answers as to why her son had died, Franklin said, quote, "just for her, just to answer her question, I'll say that it was just because they were race mixing. Had they not been race mixing, you know, it would have been a totally different story." Franklin told this reporter that he spent the majority of his time in lockup reading the Bible and praying, and that he had no remorse for the murders that he had committed. Quote, "no, I don't regret that. Not to say that they are not actions that I've done that I don't regret. I've sinned a lot in my life. Any sin that I've done, I repented of." And it's during this point in time in the early 1990s that Franklin begins admitting to all of his various crimes, the murders he had committed, the bank robberies, etc. Franklin admitted to having shot Gerald Gordon outside of the Brith Shalom Knesset Israel congregation. In November of 1994, Franklin was officially charged with this particular crime. When asked why he had not admitted to this crime in the 1980s, Franklin stated that he knew it was a death penalty case and he had no desire to face the gas chamber. However, by the 1990s, the gas chamber was a thing of the past, with most prisons using lethal injection or electrocution as their means of execution. Franklin stated that he had no fear of dying and that he was a proponent of the death penalty as he felt that it was moral and just and quote-unquote mentioned in the Bible. As before, Franklin represented himself, with his defense centering around the fact that Franklin believed the killing of Jews was morally acceptable, stating at one point, "I'm only sorry that killing Jews isn't legal." On January 13th, 1997, the jury found Franklin guilty of the murder after only 40 minutes of deliberation. Franklin gave the jury a huge smile, a thumbs up, and said, "right on." At the sentencing phase, Franklin's statements were by his own accord and that of most experts designed to get the jury to convict him and sentence him to death. Why? Because Franklin was willing to give up his life to avoid going back to Marion Federal Penitentiary. Franklin said, quote, "I talked to another inmate, and he said I should kill another man if you don't give me the death sentence. Make sure they do it next time." Quote, "decided that if you guys do not vote for the death penalty, that's what's going to happen. I'm already doing 6 consecutive life sentences already, plus some other time, and it would just be a total farce if you guys did not sentence me to death." The jury ends up deliberating for 65 minutes, and on Thursday, February 27th, 1997, Joseph Paul Franklin is sentenced to death. along with two consecutive life terms. Upon being sentenced, Franklin addressed the court, stating, "I'd just like to thank the court for a fair trial. I just felt safe when I got the death penalty. I just felt really secure now." Franklin executes a written waiver of appeal. However, his court-appointed attorneys stated that they would pursue an appeal on his behalf, whether he wanted it or not, as they felt that Franklin was a paranoid schizophrenic. Despite this, Franklin advises his lawyers to fight the death penalty conviction. Although publicly, he continued to state that he would not fight the imposition of his sentence. Telling a reporter concerning the implementation of capital punishment and individuals who have been convicted of it fighting their sentences, quote, "It disgusts me that these guys try to save their miserable lives." Following this, Franklin continued to make contact with law enforcement officials across the country, admitting his guilt in crimes that had taken place in their jurisdiction. However, many of them decided not to pursue legal trials against Franklin, as they thought it was a futile gesture given that he had been sentenced to die. This is more likely than not Franklin seeking recognition for his crimes. A lot of serial killers do this while they are active. You get the guys that write into newspapers and into the police departments. You also get the guys that start confessing after they have been sentenced, and no further sentence can be imposed upon them greater than the one that they have. They start telling everything. The flip side of that, too, is that you get guys like Keith Hunter Jesperson, the smiley face killer, who admit to numerous crimes in order to inflate their ego, despite there not being any evidence that the crimes that they are admitting to actually took place in anywhere outside of the perpetrator's own mind. On Saturday, April 25th, 1998, Franklin was given a stay of execution and transported from a Wisconsin prison to Hamilton County, Cincinnati, to face trial for the murders of 14-year-old Daryl Lane and 13-year-old Dante Evans Brown. Franklin ends up being given two life sentences after he is convicted. Franklin is going to go on to receive numerous other convictions over the next decade. Franklin is held at the Potosi Correction Center in Washington County, southeastern Missouri, where the state's execution chamber was held until 2005, when it was transferred to the Eastern Reception Diagnostic and Correctional Center in Bonne Terre, Missouri. Prisoners are held at the Potosi prison prior to being transferred to Bonne Terre for their execution. Franklin pretty much spent his time bothering prison authorities with perceived injustices concerning his treatment and living conditions, writing to law enforcement, reading from his Bible, and making contact with various members of the media. Prison officials also noted that Franklin spent an inordinate amount of time looking at pornographic magazines, as he liked to visualize himself with the women in the pictorials. It's also known that Franklin had contact with numerous members of white supremacist organizations and was allowed access to white supremacist literature, such as War, which is the magazine or newspaper printed by an organization that carries the same name, which stands for the White Aryan Resistance. However, prison officials were eventually pressured to confiscate this type of material from Franklin. On a number of occasions, Franklin was cited for sexual misconduct after removing his penis from his pants when a woman was present near his cell and masturbating himself. So basically, Franklin is spending his time locked up being a nuisance and a pervert. Eventually, however, Franklin's time on death row is going to run out. Now, a couple of things happened during the early to mid-2000s. Franklin tells reporters that he has denounced his racist views and that his reason for having committed the murders was quote-unquote illogical, as he now realizes that blacks, Asians, Jews, everyone are quote-unquote people just like us. Now, despite this newfound enlightenment, Franklin is transferred to the Eastern Reception Diagnostic and Correctional Center in Bon Terre, Missouri, in November of 2013. Initially, he is granted 2 stays of execution. However, on November 20th of that year, Franklin is brought into the execution chamber where he is administered a dose of pentobarbital at 6:07 a.m. Franklin is pronounced dead at 6:17 a.m. At the age of 63 years old, Franklin gave no last statement and, according to witnesses, was calm, collected, and reserved at the time of his execution. Now we're going to briefly look at the legacy of Joseph Paul Franklin, because Franklin didn't just commit a series of racially motivated serial murders. In fact, he gave inspiration to a whole slew of worthless pieces of shit that share similar views as he does. There is some evidence out there to suggest that individuals such as Chevy Kehoe, who I covered a few years ago, may have been influenced by Franklin, as well as the Midwest bank robbers, the Covenant, the Shield, and the Sword, and many others. But perhaps the most disturbing part of Franklin's legacy is that a by the name of William Luther Pierce. Now, Pierce was the founder of an organization known as the National Alliance, which for a period of time was the largest white supremacist organization in the United States. Pierce was noted for having written a novel under the pseudonym of Andrew McDonald, known as the Turner Diaries, which the Southern Poverty Law Center has described as the Mein Kampf of white supremacists. In 1989, Pierce published another book called Hunter, which was dedicated to Franklin, whom in the dedication Pierce said was quote-unquote a lonely hunter who saw his duty as a white man and did what a responsible man of his race must do to the best of his ability and without regard of the personal consequences. Now, many individuals have drawn inspiration not only from the book The Turner Diaries, but also from this book Hunter. The FBI has stated that they believe that Timothy McVeigh, the perpetrator of the Oklahoma City bombing, drew his inspiration from the Turner Diaries and its depiction of a fertilizer bomb being used. Whether or not this is true is up for debate, but It cannot be debated that Joseph Paul Franklin inspired many others to commit acts of murder and other criminal activities based solely on racial views. And unfortunately, it is almost a certainty that Franklin will continue to influence these types of pieces of shit for generations to come. That is going to do it this week for our show. I hope you have enjoyed this deep dive look at the only known racially motivated serial killer in American history, Joseph Paul Franklin. If you enjoyed this show, want to hear more content like this without ads, please go check out tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. It's only $1.99 a month. You get access to everything. Until next time, stay morbid.